next met with Dr. Deborah Armstrong, we began our conversation by commenting on the background of the landmark GOG trial presented at this year's ASCO plenary session, evaluating bevacizumab with chemotherapy after debulking surgery.
I think the first thing to appreciate is that the bevacizumab issue in ovarian cancer is different than it is for the other solid tumors. You know, it's FDA approved in breast, lung, and colorectal cancer because it makes chemo work better. So the studies were chemo plus or minus bevacizumab, which is what this study was. But unlike those diseases, in ovarian cancer, there's a single agent response rate, a pretty substantial one to bevacizumab, 22% in one study, 16% in another, and then another even larger chunk of patients in both of those studies who have prolonged stable disease. And I think the hope was, gee, you know, if bevacizumab can make chemotherapy work better and it has some single agent activity, we really might be pushing the envelope. So this very simply was a study of bevacizumab, paclitaxel carboplatin alone, paclitaxel carboplatin with bevacizumab during chemo, and then the third arm, which was paclitaxel carboplatin bevacizumab with the maintenance phase, and the other arms had placebo, and it was double-blinded. And there was no difference between arms one and two, so just combining bevacizumab with paclitaxel carboplatin did not make a difference. There was an improvement in progression-free survival with arm three, but at least at this point in time, no difference in survival for the three arms. And that was about a three-month improvement in progression-free survival from 10.3 months to 14.1 months. It looked like it was pretty well tolerated from a toxicity perspective. There were more GI perforations. That's been a unique toxicity in ovarian cancer. And in the recurrent patient population, it can be as high as, you know, on overall as 4 or 5%. And it was 2.8 and 2.6% on the bevacizumab arms. There was no difference in clotting events. Was some hypertension, not unexpected. And so, you know, I guess it's a question of whether you're a glass half full or a glass half empty person. Does that PFS justify the use in the absence of a survival benefit? Or will there be a survival benefit when the study's followed out long enough? It has been unblinded, so all the patients on the study know and their doctors know whether they got bevacizumab or not. And I think, you know, for me, it sort of raises the question of almost like the studies we've done of adding a third chemotherapeutic agent. It doesn't add as much probably as that chemotherapeutic agent does when you use it alone in the recurrent setting. Elizabeth Eisenhower did, I think, a wonderful discussion. She always does. She's just able to sort of put things in perspective. And she makes the point that PFS may be a legitimate endpoint for initial chemotherapy trials, but may not be a good endpoint for maintenance trials, and that this is really an amalgam of the two. The study 218 was an amalgam of the two. And then she showed an interesting slide that looked at all the randomized clinical trials of bevacizumab plus or minus chemotherapy trials. And in all of those, the PFS benefit is greater than the overall survival benefit. So the PFS is maintained, but the overall survival isn't maintained. And that was concurrent. I mean, all of those were to the upper left of the curve. And it's sort of an interesting observation over a large number of trials.
Although I guess, I mean, you do have the issue potentially of crossover, which, yeah, you know, I'm not sure how much might have happened. But the other thing that she said, I agree with you, it was a fantastic discussion, but there's one thing I didn't quite understand, because we see a lot of these studies in oncology with just a little bit of progression-free survival. It's not maybe mature enough to see survival. But she brought out the possibility that in terms of absolute benefit of survival, that conceivably, I'm not sure how she came up with this formula, this modest progression-free survival advantage conceivably could translate, and she used the number 15-month overall survival benefit, which I didn't quite get how she got, but it seemed a lot more impressive.
It's based on the hazard ratios. And because right, ovarian cancer patients live a long time after they progress, it's not like a pancreatic cancer patient who, you know, ovarian cancer patients, frankly, usually live 3 or 4 years after they're diagnosed with a recurrence. So, you know, those curves sort of continue to splay. So, you know, a hazard ratio of 0.75 for PFS and 0.75 for overall survival in the same study will turn out to be a lot more months in survival, because survival is typically 3 or 4 times as long as PFS is.
So bottom line is, at this point, and I know we're waiting, there's at least one major other study, the ION study, but what's your take in terms of clinical practice? I mean, assuming you can get it paid for, do you think this should be presented as an option to patients who could have gone in that trial?
I have to say, off study, I'm not using it in combination with chemotherapy right now, certainly not in the upfront setting. We've been particularly interested in looking at bevacizumab alone in combination with other agents that might sort of, that sequential pathway targeting. There's a lot of people interested in that. And, you know, there's some preliminary evidence that in ovarian cancer, that really does increase the response rate when you're using it as a single agent. So I have to say right now, I would agree with Elizabeth Eisenhower that right now this is not paradigm changing. I think we still have to scratch our heads a little bit. We have to look for the ultimate overall survival in this study and the outcome of the ICON-7 study, which was much more simpler, but was basically the first and the third arm of the study using half-dose bevacizumab.
So you also mentioned the issue of PARP inhibitors, and I was really quite, I don't know, kind of surprised slash stunned, I don't know, at the presentation looking at olaparib, and particularly the fact that they saw substantial responses in women with advanced ovarian cancer who did not have BRCA mutations. Of course, we had seen this before. As a matter of fact, we'd seen with olaparib before with the BRCA mutations, but maybe you can talk about what was presented there, what your thoughts were.
So the study was, I guess, sort of a 2x2. It was basically triple negative breast cancer or high-grade serous ovarian cancer. And then the patients were sort of broken down into with or without a known BRCA mutation. And the triple negative breast cancer patients did not go past the first stage. So it really wasn't a benefit. But of the 90-something patients in the study, 55 were in the high-grade serous alone. And they had a response rate that really looked pretty much equivalent to what we saw in the BRCA-associated ovarian cancers. And I think, you know, what it says to me is that that homologous recombination pathway is a characteristic of high-grade serous ovarian cancer, that abnormalities in that pathway. And you can have an abnormality in that pathway because you've inherited a BRCA mutation and then your other BRCA gene is knocked out. Or you can have somatic mutations in the BRCA genes or other genes in that pathway. And for example, there's been recent publications to suggest that RAD51, which is also involved in that pathway, may be another cause of inherited BRCA-like cancers. But there's multiple steps in that pathway. And you know, it's part of the Fanconi anemia pathway. And so there's many steps in that pathway, and that somatically, high-grade serous cancers may almost by definition have something wrong in that pathway, and therefore they are dependent on the PARP pathway, and therefore will benefit from the use of PARP inhibitors.
And it was pretty striking. They saw more than a 25% objective response rate to olaparib alone in patients without BRCA mutations. What fraction overall of ovarian cancer is BRCA-related?
So if you look at gynecologic oncology group trials, usually about 80% of the patients on, like, you know, initial chemotherapy trial for ovarian cancer will be serous carcinomas, and almost all of those are high grade. So 75-80%. The rest are endometrioid and then a smattering of clear cell and some other histologies. If you look at the data, probably about 10% of ovarian carcinoma patients will have germline BRCA mutations that are known. The incidence of that's higher in the Ashkenazi population. It's about 25% just of having ovarian cancer. And then we get into other things in those pathways that people have either have germline mutations in or have sporadic mutations in. We've been hampered by the fact that it's difficult to actually look at BRCA protein expression in tumor tissue. And the pathologists tell me it's because the normal level of expression is so low. But interestingly, there were some studies here and at Society for Gynecologic Oncology meeting earlier this year that are now finding ways by IHC and some other methods to actually look for protein expression. So even if the gene's not knocked out, you can have a lack of BRCA expression because of methylation changes that express the gene or post-translational methylation changes that affect gene expression or post-translational modifications of the proteins that make them non-functional. So I think some people estimate that somewhere around 35 to 40% of ovarian cancer may essentially be a BRCA type phenotype. And I think the data from the PARP study would support that.
If the drug were available right now, would you be using it? I mean, I don't know. Do you have trials looking at it that you can put patients on?
We have one of the gynecologic oncology group upfront trials. It's a phase one looking at a PARP inhibitor in combination with bevacizumab, paclitaxel, and carboplatin. We have another one that we're probably going to start up in the next few months. It's just really a safety and feasibility of looking at one of the PARP inhibitors with pegylated liposomal doxorubicin carboplatin. I'm just up the street from the NCI, and so I have several of my BRCA patients who've been getting both breast and ovary who have been on their carboplatin PARP inhibitor study. And I have one patient who had breast cancer and then had ovarian cancer and has probably had 7 or 8 treatments for her ovarian cancer and just came off their study after being on it since July of last year. So same type of story, which is that somebody who has been through multiple therapies and now having some benefit. There's also been some interesting data published over the last couple of years about platinum resistance in ovarian cancer patients with a BRCA mutation, that it can be explained by revertant mutations in the genes where basically the reading frame gets readjusted, and so that now the gene can be expressed again. And it's very elegant molecular work to show this. And so there's always been concerns about if somebody with the BRCA mutation is platinum resistant, have they basically reverted now to wild type BRCA function? And there actually was a study here from the British group who have been doing a lot of the work with olaparib, looking at using platinum taxane combinations after olaparib, and had response rates up, you know, around 40%. So not all of these patients are by necessity platinum resistant.
What about this issue of, is this ready for clinical use? You know, what do you say to the patient or doc who says, how can I get this for my patient?
Yeah, I think it's a tough one. I will say that there's a race on, and there's at least 7 or 8 drug companies developing PARP inhibitors now. And, you know, one of them is going to see the light of day pretty soon. And there's a couple of issues with the PARP inhibitors. Number one is, you know, we're talking about using them in patients with BRCA mutations. And many of the drug companies think if you're going to do that, you have to use them continuously. Because basically what you're using them for is that the high spontaneous mutation rate of the tumor is what you're sort of using as the equivalent of your chemotherapy, and then it then can't repair it. So you really almost have to have it continuously. And continuously blocking DNA repair might have some negative effects. We need DNA repair for, you know, recovery from sun exposure and the things that we eat and drink and breathe that aren't good for us. So there's certainly concerns about that. In other studies where it's not so much saying it's the nature of the disease, but we're going to use this to make chemo work better, with many studies with temozolomide in melanoma and glioblastoma, you can use it intermittently. You only have to use it while the drug's around. And so we're going to have to learn how to use these, and we're going to have to figure out, are we going to see more toxicity? And the nicest thing about the PARP inhibitors potentially is that at least so far, we haven't seen a lot of extra toxicity when we use them.
Now, olaparib as a single agent previously was reported to cause responses in patients with breast cancer with BRCA mutations. In this study, no responses were reported in that subset, nor with patients with triple negative breast cancer.
And so then we're going to get into, you know, are there certain specific PARP inhibitors that may work in one disease and don't work in another? And, you know, maybe like the topoisomerase 1 inhibitors, you know, one works for one type of disease and one works for another. And, you know, we've got a lot to learn about them, but I think it's a very exciting, certainly for us in the ovarian cancer world, it's a very exciting pathway.
I want to ask you about a couple other agents that are not available, but there's a lot of research being done. One that I saw your name on in a paper from ASCO was farletuzumab.
Yeah.
What is it? What does it do? And what do we know about it?
So farletuzumab is an antibody that targets the folate receptor alpha. Folate is taken up into cells by two mechanisms. One is the folate receptor alpha. The other is the reduced folate carrier. And fortunately, when you block folate receptor alpha, you still get folate into cells naturally through the reduced carrier. But the folate receptor alpha is highly overexpressed in ovarian cancer, 90%+. And the difference between normal ovary and ovarian cancer is very profound. So it was one of those rational targets. And the first study, it was a phase 1 study done at Memorial, along with some targeting that showed that ovarian tumor tissue took this up. And then we did a phase 2 trial where we allowed patients with low volume or asymptomatic disease to go on farletuzumab alone. Patients with high volume or symptomatic disease went on chemotherapy with farletuzumab. Then the patients who were on the farletuzumab alone and progressed could go on to the combination arm. And we looked at, obviously, the response rates to the combination, to the single agent. And then we also had each patient sort of serve as her own control to see if her second progression-free interval was longer than her first. And we've had pretty good data that, in general, with ovarian cancer, second progression-free interval is shorter than first in 96%+ of the cases. And so what we found was, by CA-125, very high response rate, 89%, over 70% overall response rate, and in 21% of the cases where patients had a second progression-free interval that was longer than their first. So this was the final presentation of the data from that study. That's now led to some ongoing trials right now, one in platinum-resistant disease where farletuzumab is being looked at with weekly paclitaxel in a randomized fashion, a 2-to-1 randomization. And then the registration study, which is in platinum-sensitive disease, it's a 2-to-1 with 2 different doses to try and identify the proper dose in platinum-sensitive patients with paclitaxel and carboplatin. The interesting thing, folate receptor alpha is looking like a very good target. There's another way of targeting it with this company called Endocyte, which is actually tagging chemotherapeutic agents to folate and looking at uptake. And there were a couple of presentations. One was on looking at their tumor targeting with that, just to sort of say, can you do an assay that says, what's the uptake and will that predict? And they did show a correlation with the imaging uptake and response to the agent. And the EC145 is basically this folate linked to a vinca alkaloid. And then it gets taken up into the cells by endocytosis. And the study of pegylated liposomal doxorubicin with or without this. And it was a significant benefit for the patients who got the additional treatment. So there's clearly some effect from that.
So the antibody's bringing the chemo to the tumor cell.
In the second one, yeah. In the farletuzumab, it's really just the antibody itself, and it looks like it's acting maybe similar to the way bevacizumab does in colorectal cancer, which is that it makes chemotherapy work better. So it's a very interesting and really a completely new target.
So another agent I wanted to ask you about is BIBF-1120.
Yeah, that's sort of another one that's targeting the angiogenesis pathway, and that's a study that has been going on primarily in Europe. And there's a number of, you know, obviously because of the single agent activity of bevacizumab, there's a lot of interest in targeting this pathway. And the BIBF is one. There are other studies that are looking at some new agents targeting different angiopoietins. And I think these are all looking like agents that have some activity in ovarian cancer, and how are we going to use them alone in combination with chemotherapy? And so I think it's a big field for ovarian cancer and how we're going to use all these agents. And again, as I spoke earlier, a particular interest in looking at sequential targeting of the pathway. And Elise Cohen has been working with combinations, looking at sorafenib in combination with bevacizumab. And, you know, you use something to sop up the ligand, and then you use something that targets the pathway. And those are all, I think, very exciting and potentially beneficial ways to target angiogenesis in ovarian cancer.
And this 1120 agent is a TKI, like a VEGF TKI?
Yes.
I think we talked the last time about the issue of HER2 positivity and anti-HER therapy in ovarian cancer. I've been kind of confused about this. The question comes up, you know, the idea of targeting the target as opposed to the primary tumor.
Yeah.
Dennis Slamon has been talking to me about this for a long time in terms of breast cancer. We saw the TOGA trial last year looking at trastuzumab and gastric cancer. Where are we right now in understanding HER2 and ovarian cancer, and specifically pertuzumab?
Yeah. Well, the HER2 story, certainly looking at trastuzumab, is pretty much on the back burner with ovarian cancer. You know, I think that most of us feel that if we have high-level expression in ovarian cancer, like we do in, you know, a substantial minority of breast cancer, that there is a possibility that something like trastuzumab might work. But it's turning out to be such a small fraction in ovarian cancer that it's pretty hard to identify that subgroup. There's a lot more interest in that back when we were trying to figure out, you know, how we would use trastuzumab. Pertuzumab, which is different and is probably not as dependent on high-level overexpression as trastuzumab is, basically blocks the binding of HER1 or EGFR and HER2. And, you know, there's clearly been some very provocative data to suggest that EGFR overexpression is a negative prognostic factor in ovarian cancer. But the EGFR1, you know, the targeting in ovarian cancer, frankly, has been pretty disappointing. So there was this interest in saying, well, maybe pertuzumab, which is something that can work through a different fashion, might be an interesting agent. And so there's been a series of studies that have been done with pertuzumab in ovarian cancer, looking at combinations of gemcitabine with or without pertuzumab. And that was a negative study, but they looked at levels of expression of HER3 and thought they could distinguish patients who might potentially benefit. So ongoing studies then have been looking at trying to break those patients out into HER3 expression with the thought that the dimerization with HER2 and HER3 might be something that's important in ovarian cancer. So far, not looking like a highly positive outcome in ovarian cancer. And I know that now they're looking also at that in breast cancer as well to try and see if there's ways that you can combine trastuzumab and a pertuzumab-like approach in breast cancer. But I have to say, kind of disappointing outcome in ovarian cancer.
I know at one point the GOG was talking about looking at pertuzumab either in specifically defined subsets based on, as you mentioned, HER3 or dimerization, or maybe in patients overall. Is that moving forward?
I don't think the GOG is moving forward with that. At least at this point in time, there's no active studies.
All right, let's talk about your patients, beginning with your 73-year-old woman.
So this was a patient, I present her just because of this sort of unusual natural history of ovarian cancer in patients with the BRCA mutation. But in 1969, when she was 33, she had breast cancer diagnosed, and she's my only patient who had a true Halstead radical mastectomy, no adjuvant therapy at that time. And then in 1983, at the age of 47, she was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer and underwent surgery and then had cyclophosphamide and cisplatin. I first met her in 1995 when, at the age of 59, she developed either recurrent ovarian cancer or a new primary peritoneal cancer. We weren't sure which. And she underwent a debulking and then paclitaxel and carboplatin chemotherapy. And next year, she had BRCA testing, and it revealed she had a deleterious mutation in BRCA1. And then 2 years after her recurrence in 1997, she relapsed in a periaortic lymph node. And that was resected, and then we radiated the nodal bed. She again did well for 2 years until she relapsed in her lung and underwent a wedge resection that included some hyalur nodes, which were involved, and then single-agent carboplatin chemotherapy. And she's been disease-free from her ovarian cancer since that time, so that's now 11 years. Interestingly, last year she developed a new contralateral breast cancer that was a 1.1 centimeter low-grade ERPR positive node negative cancer, and this may not even be a BRCA-associated cancer. People with BRCA mutations are allowed to get sporadic cancers, and this has a typical characteristic of a late-in-life hormone receptor-positive low-grade cancer. And she has some other health issues going on now and is on anticoagulation and has some other issues, particularly cardiac issues, so we're actually not even giving her any hormonal therapy. But, you know, these are some of the stories we see in BRCA-associated ovarian cancers where the patients do much better than you expect, particularly after platinum type of therapy.
This seems like extraordinarily good outcome, though. I mean, 10 years now after having biopsy-proven or surgical-proven metastatic disease.
And I have a couple of other patients like her. And, you know, over the years, many of us have seen patients in our practice where they just seem like they need some platinum every couple of years. They don't seem to relapse earlier after that. And looking back on some of those, I suspect they may be BRCA-associated cancers. I have another woman with a BRCA mutation, and she had actually developed a breast cancer, a triple-negative breast cancer, while she was on chemotherapy for ovarian cancer, so sort of scary. But now her last ovarian cancer treatment for recurrent disease was in 2005. So I just saw her a couple weeks ago, and she's been breast cancer and ovarian cancer free and had recurrent ovarian cancer now for 5 years.
Just out of curiosity, at any point, was there discussion with her about prophylactic mastectomy prior to her getting the breast cancer?
We had not because, interestingly, although she had a family history of ovarian cancer, she didn't have a family history of breast cancer. And we tested her after she had her breast surgery. She had breast-conserving therapy. And interestingly, the data from BRCA-associated breast cancer is that the in-breast recurrence rate for those patients isn't higher than it is for sporadic patients. The other breast you have to worry a lot about, and so we do enhanced screening in these patients if they choose not to have bilateral mastectomies. Some people very much, they don't want to face another cancer. Some people, it's worth a lot to save the breast. So,
interesting. How about your 60-year-old woman?
So this is a patient I brought up just to show this issue of bevacizumab activity in ovarian cancer. And this is a woman, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer at the age of 60, and she had very extensive pelvic and peritoneal implants, ascites, and large volume disease at the root of the mesentery. And a very good and qualified gynecologic oncologist said, I'm not going to be able to optimally debulk you. Did a paracentesis, showed high-grade serous carcinoma, and decided to give her neoadjuvant paclitaxel carboplatin. And unfortunately, she did not respond to that. So she then got 3 cycles of topotecan again without response. And at the time that I saw her then, she came for consideration for clinical trial, and we had the GOG bevacizumab study open 170D. And she couldn't even quite go 7 days between palliative paracenteses at that time. And her CA125 was almost 7,000. So we started her on GOG 170 with bevacizumab at 15 milligrams per kilogram IV. And I have to say, I was very concerned because I didn't hear from her a week later because I'd been getting her set up for weekly paracenteses, and I was really concerned. So I called her at home and she said, oh, I was just out shopping. She says, I don't know what you gave me, but my fluid's gone. I can eat. And so this lady who had progressed through Taxol, carboplatin, and topotecan actually had a very significant benefit from bevacizumab and actually was on this study. She was the first patient I treated with bevacizumab and was on this study for 21 months before she ultimately progressed. I also use her as an illustration that we have seen this occasionally in patients with ovarian cancer, which is that their CA125 sometimes becomes not predictable. And her CA125, which was 6,000 or 7,000 when she started, actually went up to 20,000, one of the highest ones I've seen in the first 5 months, and then gradually came back down to 5,000 and then stayed at 5,000 until just toward the end when she progressed. And we did nothing different during that period of time, and I have no idea why that was. But I always tell people that treating patients with a CA125 alone with bevacizumab, you have to be careful that you don't stop treatment because it could actually be working.
Well, also it brings up the question of how much of the effect on these patients is anti-tumor effect as opposed to some type of angiogenic anti-aesthetic effect.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up because I think that it probably actually does have some direct anti-tumor effect in ovarian cancer because we see both excess production of the ligand and overexpression of the VEGF receptors in ovarian cancer. So, you know, you sort of have this autocrine loop and you may be interfering with that pretty significantly.
Did she have any bevacizumab issues, hypertension, proteinuria?
She had already had hypertension when she went on the study, and it did worsen. And she was my first patient, and she was on a study. I was all over her, and we actually even did a kidney biopsy, you know, just because of her proteinuria and her hypertension. But, you know, it's very typical findings that are seen with bevacizumab, and we just needed to change her medications, and she was fine with it, but no other difficulties with it. And it was really a pretty amazing first patient to have on that study.
You mentioned the issue of bowel perforation when we were talking about the plenary presentation, the earlier stage disease. At this point, how do you put together sort of the bowel perforation bevacizumab story that's been evolving over the last few years?
Yeah. Well, I have to say one of the things about this patient is she'd be somebody I'd be very anxious about a bowel perforation in today. The second bevacizumab alone study got stopped early because in the first 44 patients, there were 5 bowel perforations, one of which was fatal. And nobody was quite sure what was causing that. It didn't seem to be just in patients who were responding. Concerns were about, you know, maybe many ovarian cancer patients have bowel surgery, you know, as part of their debulking. But, you know, most colon cancer patients have had bowel surgery, and we don't see that rate in colon cancer. And most of us, our best guess is that in patients who have extensive serosal involvement with disease, and therefore the metabolic demands of the bowel wall are greater, that when you interfere with vasculature in that situation, that you may just be set up for a perforation or fistula, which is, I think of as a perforation equivalent in ovarian cancer. So, you know, most of us feel like the patients who are having that sort of bowel problem that a lot of ovarian cancer patients will have with sort of obstipation, laxative dependence kind of thing. I have to say, I try to be pretty hard-nosed now about bevacizumab and making sure that my patients can stay hydrated and stable weight for at least a month or so before we think about using it in them, because if not, I just worry that they're at high risk for perforation.
You mentioned the CA-125, which actually I see that you plotted and kind of went up initially and then came back down.
Yeah.
What about objective assessment of her tumor?
So she actually had never had her ovaries out. And so her biggest site of disease was her bilateral adnexal masses, and these very clearly responded. The first thing that we saw in the scans was obviously the resolution of ascites, and you can see particularly on her pelvic scan, you know, all of her intestines beforehand are sort of mushed there in the middle, and afterward, you know, really complete resolution of the pelvic ascites. She had a little residual perihepatic ascites. The other is, if you look at her gastric wall, how thick it is in the initial study, like, you know, there's almost, the gastric wall is almost thicker than the lumen of the, and you can see then in the second one that the gastric wall is much better distended. And again, she said, I don't care what my CA-125 is, I don't care what my scans show, I'm better. So that was one of those sort of amazing Lazarus kind of stories, because she was pretty devastated by the ascites. It was pretty tough.
So you think she had tumor in the gastric wall?
Oh, yeah. I mean, many of these patients will have almost like that lichen kind of planus kind of thing where they have decreased. And that's actually why a lot of patients with ovarian cancer, they will have sort of bowel obstruction symptoms. But when you do the imaging studies, they don't have a cutoff point. They just sort of almost have a functional ileus because the bowel wall is so stiff from basically the rind or the cake of tumor that's on the outside of the, on the serosal surface of the intestines.
Fascinating. I guess we're not, and I ask this to everybody when we talk about bevacizumab, whether it's breast, lung, colon, kidney, gliomas, or whatever, in terms of trying to find predictors of response. How do you find a patient like this as opposed to somebody who's not going to respond? Anything that you've seen that looks promising?
Well, you know, there actually were some correlative studies along with GOG-170D to try and look at that. And at least so far, you know, we haven't seen clear predictors of who's going to respond and who's not. We do see variable levels of VEGF expression in the tumors. But I know there's some interest now in looking at some of the more targeted molecular assays to try and look at some other predictors potentially of bevacizumab response. But no, I think you're right, especially with an agent that has some toxicity, although certainly I think by the overall patient perspective, much better tolerated than chemo, but to try and find who's going to benefit and who's not.
Let's talk about your 69-year-old woman, and seems like this maybe relates also to some of the stuff that happened at ASCO. What happened with her?
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about her just because of this whole issue of screening, and she's a lady who at 69 was actually participating in the PLCO screening study through the NIH, which was prostate, lung, colon, and ovary. So she's one of the few patients I have who has some CA-125s before she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And she went basically from, she had a 13, a 0, 0, 85, and 559 with every 3-month intervals. And when she went up to 85, 2 sequential rises, she had an ultrasound which showed an abnormality and was ultimately diagnosed with stage 3C ovarian cancer. She was not considered high risk, no family history of ovarian cancer or early onset breast cancer, and so did not, you know, appear to be a BRCA associated type. She was just interested in doing the screening study because she lived near the NIH and you know, was doing that sort of for interest's sake. And I just bring this up because of this whole issue of CA125 screening. And I think one of the exciting studies that was presented at ASCO this year is a study from Karen Liu at MD Anderson, who led a screening study looking at annual CA125s using this, what's called ROCA, which is the risk of ovarian cancer algorithm. And it's basically an algorithm that takes into account the patient's age, the CA125, and then recalculates every time so that basically each patient then will have her own baseline CA125, and a change in that CA125, whether it's from 3 to 6 or, you know, from somebody who might have a baseline that's 50 to 75 will prompt an intervention. And the study was designed so that they would consider it a positive outcome if they had a positive predictive value of 10%, meaning that they only had to do 10 surgeries for every ovarian cancer that was diagnosed. And in fact, it was 37%. They had 8 patients and 3 invasive ovarian cancers. And fortunately, they were all early stage 1 and stage 2, where the cure rate is higher. And of the 8 patients who had surgery, 2 of them had what are called low malignant potential tumors, which although they're not invasive cancers, those patients ultimately almost always need to have surgery anyway. So I guess I wouldn't personally consider those unnecessary surgeries. The interesting thing about the study that Karen Liu presented, which is being done in a similar fashion in the UK by Usha Menon and Ian Jacobs, is that it was not done in the high-risk population. It was specifically done in women over the age of 50 who did not have a family history. And the same is true with the UK study. We have been focusing on our high-risk patients to do screening studies because your numerator is higher for your denominator, and that way you're going to have more cases. But we may have been sort of led down a blind alley with that, because it may be that those high-risk patients, potentially because they're younger or because their disease progresses more quickly, really aren't good patients for screening. And the vast majority of patients who develop ovarian cancer aren't considered high-risk. Most of them are sporadic. So I think the good news is that we might be on to a way to screen for ovarian cancer in the general population where most of the cases of ovarian cancer arise. The ongoing UK study that's actually will be the definitive study because it's going to look at mortality as an outcome. And then there's also some interest in looking at other markers in conjunction with CA125, HE4, and a couple of others. I think, you know, we're starting to see the light for ovarian cancer screening, in which case we hopefully can diagnose patients earlier and avoid the morbidity and mortality of ovarian cancer.
I have to confess that I'm a closet screening skeptic in general in terms of cancer. I'm going to get traumatized by breast and prostate cancer, I guess. I mean, this lady was in a screening study and she gets diagnosed with stage 3 C disease.
Well, I think, and the thing that's interesting about her is, you know, if she had been in ROCA, she would have only been getting markers done once a year. But I will say that I think in this study, she had to have 2 sequential markers go up. But I think it's a little bit of a sobering graph to look at, absolutely, in her case.
So what actually happened with her?
Well, the interesting thing with this patient was she had fairly bad Parkinson's disease and really suffered during chemotherapy. And one of the reasons I actually also show her graph is that we very carefully decided that we wouldn't treat based on her CA125 alone. We would wait till she had measurable disease. And she was one of those patients where I had to see her as often and image her as often as I was somebody on treatment. But you can see here that her CA125 actually went up to 1,500 before she actually had any imageable disease.
And she had debulking surgery first?
She had back there at time 12 months when her CA125 was 559. We didn't do surgery again with her recurrence. And I guess, unfortunately, we were right, which is that probably not so much related to chemotherapy, but maybe to the drugs that we have to give with chemotherapy, you know, the antiemetics and stuff. And her Parkinson's really worsened. And she developed essentially like a locked-in syndrome and did very poorly as a result of that.
Just taking a step back in terms of the general approach to these patients, where are we today right now with intraperitoneal therapy? Any new research advances? What's going on in clinical practice?
So, you know, I think what's happened is there's believers and there's not believers. And so those of us who believe have continued to give IP therapy. There's been a lot of clinical trials going on in the last couple of years looking at trying to replace carboplatin in place of cisplatinum just to improve toxicity. The upfront GOG trial for optimally debulked patients right now is an IP carboplatin regimen versus an IP cisplatin regimen versus an IV regimen with weekly paclitaxel, looking at the Japanese GOG regimen, which I support that study because I think that the magnitude of the benefit for the weekly paclitaxel in the Japanese GOG study was the same as we saw with the IP study. So if you can get that same benefit by giving weekly paclitaxel, I think that's fine. So I actually encourage my patients to go on that study. At ASCO this year, Carolyn Krasner presented a study that was a collaboration between the GYN SPOR institutions that looked at her all IP regimen, which is basically weekly paclitaxel IP, carboplatin every 3 weeks IP, and then adding in bevacizumab just to show that that was feasible. Carolyn's done some very interesting work looking at basically the pharmacology of the intraperitoneal administration with the first cycle and the last cycle to show that the PK is really similar for both the platinum and the taxane. The repeated IP administrations aren't doing something to the peritoneal surface that alters the surface. So, you know, we participate in that study as well. And that was actually very feasible to be able to give bevacizumab with that. The GOG 252 study that I talked about is currently including bevacizumab in all the arms, but a decision after the presentation from 218 about whether that will continue or not, I think that's still pending.
Is there a maintenance treatment with that?
With the GOG 252, there is. There is maintenance treatment, yes.
So it goes out to, what, 15 months also?
Well, you know, I don't have anybody who's out that far yet, but I actually think it's going on till progression in the study as opposed to stopping at 15 months.
Where are we? Anything new in terms of the treatment of recurrent ovarian cancer, both platinum-sensitive and insensitive?
Yeah, we haven't completely left just straight chemotherapeutic agents behind. There was actually a very interesting presentation from a European group looking at pegylated irinotecan. And, you know, we haven't really used it. Irinotecan didn't have a lot of activity in ovarian cancer, and we kind of, for our topo 1 inhibitor, you know, we've been using topotecan. But this study was actually pretty interesting, and they actually had pretty good response rates to pegylated irinotecan, even in a fairly chemo-refractory population, and was pretty well tolerated. Certainly didn't have the kind of diarrhea, you know, that we tended to see with irinotecan, at least in the initial ovarian cancer studies. Probably falling a little bit behind breast cancer, there are a couple of studies looking at nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel Abraxane in ovarian cancer. The gynecologic oncology group, platinum-resistant Q, which is the 126Q, there was a report on the use of Abraxane in there, and we sort of used as our hallmark a response rate of 20% or greater in that. This was 126R, so you can see how far along we are in the alphabet. And this is only the fourth study that's shown a response rate of 20% or greater. And interestingly, of those four, three are taxanes. One is weekly paclitaxel, one is docetaxel, and now we have the nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel. And the fourth one is pemetrexed. And as you know, that's not FDA approved for ovarian cancer, so we have some difficulty getting it. But those are the only agents in that queue for platinum and taxane-resistant ovarian cancer that have shown response. So, you know, the taxanes remain a good group of drugs for ovarian cancer, and sort of finding a different way to give a taxane, even in somebody who's recurred within 6 months of a sort of standard every 3 week paclitaxel, looks like, you know, it shows activity in ovarian cancer.
How do you go about deciding, you know, outside a protocol setting what to do?
Yeah, I think there's a number of things we look at. What kind of toxicities the patients had with their initial therapy? You know, do they still have residual neurotoxicity? Do they want to come in for a weekly treatment? Would they prefer, you know, something oral? Oral etoposide is a good drug. It's probably underutilized. From convenience, pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, which is an IV every 4 weeks, is hard to beat. Weekly Taxol is a very active drug. We are doing a lot of studies looking at combining targeted biologic agents with weekly paclitaxel. So we actually have a lot to choose from. And I have to say, it's really more convenience or inconvenience of the schedule and what residual toxicities the patients have that really drive that decision more than anything else.
How about selection of therapy in the platinum-sensitive situation?
You know, there's been several studies now that have looked at the use of single-agent platinum versus platinum combination. So there was one with carboplatin versus carboplatin paclitaxel. There was the AGO study of gemcitabine carbo versus carboplatin alone. And I think most of us would agree that there's certainly PFS benefit for using a platinum-based combination, and in some cases, an overall survival benefit. So most of us in patients who are out more than 6 to 12 months will use a platinum-based combination. Last year, we had the presentation from the Calypso study, and so I think a lot of people are moving toward that. That's a very patient-friendly regimen, no alopecia, every 4 weeks.
That's liposomal doxorubicin.
That's right, yeah. Calyx is their name in Europe, so nice name for a study. And so most of us have been looking at those kinds of combinations and using those fairly routinely, certainly in our patients who are out more than 12 months. You know, there remains some question in the 6 to 12-month group. You try some alternative. You know, obviously there is some data looking at the pegylated liposomal doxorubicin and trabectedin. Trabectedin not being FDA approved in the U.S., but, you know, is something that's being used in Europe. Then using platinum after that, in those patients and documenting a response. There was a presentation on that at ASCO as well. There was a study that looked at the combination of carboplatin with Abraxane, nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel. And, you know, it's pretty typical of sort of a non-randomized trial, but they had a response rate of 79% and a median PFS of 13 months. And that's certainly pretty good compared to the randomized trials. We obviously, you know, when you then take that into a randomized setting, you know, usually those don't hold up. But that looked like a very reasonable combination. But given that the cost of that drug is significantly higher than the other taxanes, I don't know how much that's going to get absorbed readily into use.
You mentioned the different taxanes, and one of them you mentioned was docetaxel. Are there any situations where you use that? And if so, in what situations?
You know, if you go back several years ago now, the Scott Rock study looked at docetaxel carbo compared to paclitaxel carbo in newly diagnosed patients. And I have to say that the outcomes in terms of response, whether it was measurable disease or CA125, was really identical. The differences were toxicity. With the docetaxel, there's more myelosuppression, actually more hypersensitivity reactions, but there's more neurotoxicity with the paclitaxel combination. So I have to say, you know, if I have a patient who is very cognizant of neurotoxicity, you know, whose job may depend on minimizing neurotoxicity, I think that's a situation where docetaxel actually makes a lot of sense. But I have to say, in the GYN community, it has not gotten a lot of uptake.